Rough Trade is giving away a third of the first 3 months of the Rough Trade Club plus new music membership exclusively to 101 Part-Time Jobs listeners. Become a member of Rough Trade Club New Music and you'll receive the Rough Trade Album of the Month straight to your door every month on an exclusive vinyl pressing with bonus material. Club members have received exclusive pressings of albums from Sufjan Stevens, Sprints, The Last Dinner Party, English Teacher, and Over Mono, just to name a few, this past year alone. Sign up using the promo code CLUB101POD and you'll get Rough Trade's Album of the Month, Camera Obscura's Look to the East, Look to the West, for a third of the usual price. By signing up, you'll be getting Rough Trade's exclusive issue of the album on opaque purple in a gatefold sleeve, plus a bonus CD containing 5 demos. Don't want the album of the month but still want all the benefits? Sign up to the standard tier using CLUB101POD and you'll still get the first month free. You'll also get free shipping on all orders, 10% off at the bar and on secondhand vinyl in store, and exclusive access to sold out Rough Trade events. So don't hang around. Head to roughtrade.com/club and sign up with the code CLUB101POD. That's CLUB101POD and claim money off Rough Trade's Album of the Month today. This offer is for UK residents only. Do you play in bands? I did for the longest time, and I wish that I knew that DistroKid was a thing. I don't even think it existed back then. DistroKid makes music distribution fun and easy with unlimited uploads, and artists keep 100% of your royalties and earnings. 1 million+ artists rely on DistroKid to get their music on Spotify, Apple, YouTube, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram, and all the major streaming services. When you get DistroKid, you can see a DistroKid bank and withdraw your earnings. You get notified when you've earned royalties and you can withdraw via the app. And you can even check your streaming stats on Spotify and Apple. Get 30% off your first year on DistroKid by going to distrokid.com/VIP/101pod. 30% off for your first year. That's not bad. We know it's a tough world out there. Why don't you make it easier for yourself? And to get 30% off that free year as an artist, where you get 100% of your royalties and earnings, go to distrokid.com/VIP/101pod. All right, stay with me. I'll be right back after this. Hello, you're listening to 101 Part-Time Jobs podcast, where I speak to musicians, bands, and artists about the story of their survival and their experiences along their way. I'm so excited to welcome Catherine Woods from Fresh to the show. We've known each other for a long time, Catherine and I. From hearing the first Fresh demo, Get Bent, there was something special about it, and that's always remained in her songwriting. None even more so than on their new record, The Summer I Got Good at Guitar, an EP out now on Specialist Subject Records. I'm sure if you're listening to this, then you've already heard it, but I implore you to go and buy it, and I think they've got a great t-shirt design from John O'Gans still for sale if it hasn't sold out already. But thank you so much for listening to 101 Part-Time Jobs podcast. Last week, I announced a book to celebrate 101 episodes. If you go onto 101parttimejobs.com, you can find it there. It's a 35-page illustrated by John O'Gans and Eva Nagengast as well. Hardback, full of stories from Thurston Moore, Brian Devendorf of The National, Marika Hackman, Izzy B. Phillips of Black Honey, Tim Burgess, and a whole lot more. So you can go onto 101parttimejobs.com for that. There's about 20 left, and I'm really excited about getting them in the post next week and sending them out. East London Signature Brew have been making beers with bands since 2011. They've made beers with Mastodon, Idols, Sports Team, and a whole lot more. If you go on to signaturebrew.co.uk, you can get 10% off with the voucher code 101podcast, all capital letters. Right, that's all the housework done. Here's Catherine Woods from Fresh. Go well. You're on the campaign trail for, you know, for the new record, for the new EP. What are you laughing at?
Shaking a couple babies, kissing a couple hands. That is exactly how it feels.
Really?
A little bit.
I mean, releasing records is pretty, you know, it's a range of emotions, right?
It is. And all those emotions are like highly like synthesized because of lockdown. Like you're literally just playing like fantasy band. You're doing it all through a screen. Like obviously like social media and like virtual stuff is really important regardless of, you know, pandemic status, but it's all we have now. Like I've got like no tour or like show to kind of like pad it out. So it feels like maybe like 30% more surreal just because of that.
You're going to bed not like your ears ringing, right? Where you can be like, oh, that was a good show. Or
yeah, exactly.
Did you lot, you know, at some point during lockdown have a kind of a sit down or at least a kind of communications thing where you're like, okay, what can we, you know, what can we do? Mm. How can we make this the best for people who like Fresh, but also for us?
I think that well, we did have a proper discussion with Specialist Subject where we were like, we want to go all out on this and kind of like really commit to like just kind of pushing it from a press perspective, which was kind of exciting. And it felt like the right thing to do after kind of just like also, you know, it's not like we're sacrificing or like we're putting aside all the kind of maybe more like natural progression stuff. It's just kind of like adding it on, and we'd already done it with the other albums. So yeah, it felt like it made sense. And that was quite exciting.
That's a conversation I love to have because I look back at my experience and, you know, think I did things differently. When you kind of hit the nail in the head, you know, the way I think about it just then, in the way that, I mean, there's so many different parts here, especially in indie rock, punk rock, whatever you want to call it, where there is this kind of attitude, and I don't really know where it comes from, but it's like, you know, you kind of earn your stripes kind of thing, which I have never really fucked with. I've never really agreed with that. I, you know.
Yeah, I agree. Like the playing field wasn't even to start out with. So what's this kind of like bullshit, like posturing badge earning thing gonna, you know, if you know, it's not real. I can imagine like if you could like apply it in some kind of way where like but you know, like some kind of like really stringent moral ethical way of like recognizing people's commitment to something and hard work and stuff, like that's fine. But I don't think that's the kind of thing that we're both talking about. Like I actually think that kind of posturing is just designed to kind of maybe, I don't know, make people feel self-conscious about how they see their own art when they want to promote it, and maybe make them feel kind of just too shy or like retiring to kind of maybe even start or even try. I don't know. I think, yeah, that's a really interesting point.
I mean, it feels like when that is present, and it, you know, it's present in, kind of manifests itself in different ways from, you know, when like, you know, someone might just say an offhand comment and you were like, what the fuck? Shut up.
Yeah. I do remember like after Withdraw came out, like someone kind of, a few people kind of just went like, oh, you guys have gotten, you know, really busy or I think they even said really big, which is silly, I think. But, you know, they'd say that. And I think kind of I had that exact kind of maybe wrongly defensive kind of like thing. But I just remember kind of just saying back, quite quickly, just like, well, you know, we work really hard. Like, yeah, like,
fuck it, you should be defensive. I wish I'd have told some people to do one.
I don't want people to think that I'm being, you know, look, my genuinely, I'm not. Some people are scared of dying, some people are scared of living their life alone without love. I'm scared of hurting people's feelings. That's my biggest fear in life. And so for me to be like, to prioritize my feelings is probably speaks volumes about how I feel about that in terms of like how I reply to that.
And it kind of goes hand in hand with your lyrics, I think. And I think you're such a brave lyricist.
Well, thank you.
You're saying how you feel. And I think that's fucking hard.
It is. And I think the only reason I do that is because I would not dare speak it. That frustration builds up over time, and then, I mean, I don't know if it's a question of bravery. It's just like because I don't allow myself that outlet in like a conversational, direct speech kind of way. I literally just, it has to go somewhere, and maybe that is a good thing. I wish I was more, not confrontational, but more able to channel that energy of my lyrics and my performing into my everyday life. But I think also that's just part of being in your 20s and like growing as a person. So hopefully there's still some development to be done in that area.
and playing music and being the lyricist, I'm sure you've thought of this quite a lot. You're growing in, you're growing very publicly.
That's what I love about music and about being in a band. You have this kind of really unique, cool way to like reflect upon yourself. It sounds quite selfish, but like I've always thought that like there's kind of a narrative that bands, especially when it's like queer bands or bands with women in them, and it's not an untrue narrative, but there's this kind of idea forced upon yourself that you're a band and you're speaking for other people, or you're kind of like you're helping other people and stuff. But I do think at the core of it, at least for me, and I think a lot more people than they'd like to admit, you're doing a band for yourself. Mm-hmm. It's a selfish venture, and that's not a bad thing.
Agreed.
I think it would be really noble to start out a band with the intent of helping people, but I really don't think that happens a lot. I don't think we should pretend that that's a thing. I think it's great if it does help people, but it, you know, it's definitely never been an aim afresh. I'm glad it is an effect, but it's not never been an aim.
Is that something that you lot can talk about? Have you been able to reflect on that and grow after talking about it?
Within the band, I think the others are very, I know that the others are very respectful of my lyrics and my space, in that we talk about my lyrics, but only kind of after everything's been recorded, maybe. I think they don't ever want to sway my lyrics such to the point that they're very reticent about it. Mm-hmm. We've had some instances where someone at a show will talk to me about how they've overcome things and Fresh was in their life at that time. And then I think, which is amazing. But again, it makes me worried because, like, you know, the first thing I say is like, that's crazy because that song helped me as well. That's why I wrote it, like, because it was for me. And I'm so glad that it was there for you. But I want you to know that you did that yourself. And
100%.
I always want to make that clear and put that forward without dismissing what they're saying to me. And then when that happens, like, I guess I'll like turn to Dan or George or whoever's at merch, and I'll be like, that's insane. And they'll be like, yeah. So I think that's probably the extent of what we discussed, just because we kind of, the others in Fresh really are really supportive of me as a lyricist, and we already know who's got what role. So it doesn't, we don't speak about it as much as maybe people would assume.
It's a funny thing, you know, mentioning roles. Wayne Kramer from the MC5, I think, you know, I've read a few times when he said, like, from the very start, we had to have roles. We had to have defined roles.
Absolutely.
And it seems kind of like anti-fun to do that. But doesn't that, I mean, I feel like that's smart.
Oh, no, absolutely. I think people, when you say the word like roles, people think of a business team or something corporate, but it's the exact opposite. It's like what all those kind of like late 80s bands talked about, like jamming econo and like, you know, approaching touring and being in a band in a kind of like analytical, critical way. And like, yeah, I think it stops further confusion down the line, and also it makes people feel like they're all contributing to the band, even if they're not writing the lyrics.
Yeah.
Or, you know, even like I have no input really about the drum part. So, you know, it's good that I know that my role in the band is to write the lyrics, for example. And like, yeah, I think Fresh is actually, just by coincidence, not because I knew this when I started Fresh, but just because of personalities and the way things worked out, like, we all have really, really clear, distinct roles, and we have since the start, which has been great.
I think that kind of organizational part of it is so interesting, because to me, that's the most punk thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Saying
absolutely.
The word punk is funny. But it's true, right? I mean, for me, it's true.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that's what is at the root of my, yeah, well, we work really hard comment that for some reason is still in my head, even though that incident happened years ago, not years ago, mm-hmm. but, well, mm-hmm. 2 years ago now, I guess. But, like, people don't, they see the public-facing thing, which is, I mean, you know, it's probably, what, like 30% of the whole process? Like,
yeah.
So much less now in COVID, unfortunately, yeah. because it's the bit I like the most. But it's, even though I love the performing and I love playing shows and I love touring and it's why I started a band, it's absolutely the thing I love the most. But even I have to like admit it's not the most important part. You know, it's not the part where the progress is made. You kind of have to eat your vegetables and, you know, like,
I like that.
Make sure
like
you're that. On top of answering emails and thinking out of the box for cool ways to like present your like your record sleeves and like, yeah, you have to really be an artist and, you know, I don't know, a speech writer and, you know, all yeah. of these different things. You talked about the press circuit. Like, you have to be a bit of a politician. And, oh my God, I'm going to get cancelled. But you have to think out of ways to use your charisma to get people to care about your music.
I mean, I think it's interesting because as like an indie rock, punk rock band, it does seem like there's not that many avenues to reach new people.
Yeah, it's crazy how once you've hit a target that you, well, not a target, but like something that you'd entertained in your mind, once you've hit that, it's meaningless. Not in a devaluing way in terms of like journalism and press, but like you realize that it speaks absolutely nothing to your ultimate identity in the band. And that's like a continuing conundrum of promoting and being in such a restrictive genre, you know, just in terms of, yeah, how it's written about and stuff.
Absolutely. Trying to stay on top of that, trying to be aware of it, but also because I often think with press releases, I know this because I'm a sort of a part-time writer,
yeah.
where it's the easiest thing for a journalist to just kind of, you know, use different words, use the thesaurus of what's in the press release. So you actually do have a really big ability to put these words in people's heads, to put them in their mouths.
Yeah, like depending on the publication, depending on the amount of time or resources the journalists have, they'll copy and paste a press release.
For real?
Hopefully they won't, and hopefully they'll embellish it. But like, I'm not going to fault them for that. But
I think
we should.
I think we should fault them.
I mean, you know, my first, it wasn't a job. And so I was considering about this for the podcast, but it was unpaid. But my first kind of like foray into work in music was when I wrote for a music publication, and I did it as a teenager so that I could get into shows for free because I couldn't afford tickets. I would like do interviews and do live reviews and features. I interviewed like the Front Bottoms and Prawn and kind of
great
fireworks and stuff, like pop punk bands. And the amount of time I put into that, even though it was unpaid, I'm glad I did that. I'm also really angry I did that, but you know, I think, yeah, I don't know where I'm going with this, but
you are totally 101 part-time jobs. This is the place. Like you're doing my job for me. You're steering the ship. Thank you. Where was your thinking at the time? What was your kind of route into that?
Well, so I probably started that at about 17, but when I was 16, I had guitar lessons at my school, and our guitar teacher was, I think he'd played in bands and he'd been a session musician, I think, for some kind of mainstreamy stuff. So he would get me tickets to shows like Fall Out Boy and Noah and the Whale and stuff.
Great.
And he would say, "Oh, well, you should write a review for me." Like he'd kind of turn it into homework, which I was fine about. And then at that time, I was only just learning guitar, so I liked singing and writing. but I didn't know if that, I mean, you know, I've always been the kind of person to hedge my bets and do lots of different things. So I was like, maybe I'll be a journalist, maybe I'll be a music journalist. Like, I like English lit and I like writing and I like music. So maybe I'll write about music. And it was just something. And I mean, it was necessity as well, because I couldn't afford to go to the amount of shows I wanted to go to. So, yeah. And also, like, to be 17, your ego definitely wants to be on guest lists and stuff, even though it's all meaningless. So it was kind of like a social thing and like an aspirational thing. And just, I think at that time, and for so long after that, I wanted to be close to music in any way. I was like willing to do anything and like forego any kind of roles. Like before Fresh, I would like answer ads about like punk bands wanting like bassists or guitarists, and I wouldn't even really like the music, but I didn't know that, you know, in my mind it was the best I was gonna get. And I was, oh, imagine if I got to be in a band and play bass in a band that toured, or imagine, you know. So I was just, you know, kind of like inserting myself into all these different roles in music, hoping that one would work out.
That's good energy. Yeah. I like that a lot.
It is, but it's also a bit naive. And I think I should have had more confidence in myself.
Because, so you were like, doing those things, but you still didn't feel that confident?
Not in my instrument abilities, for sure.
Right.
Like the reason I would like answer ads for bass players was because I thought bass was easier than guitar. Which different people who play bass will tell you different things about. So I'm not going to enter into that dilemma. But hey, two less strings, right? But yeah, I definitely at that time, because it was, you know, it was kind of on me. I was not listening to any women. So I thought that the only way I could be in music as a musician was to be the supporting, you know, supporting person in a man's band. And I thought that I would just piggyback off that. And at first, just playing music in a room was enough, but that quickly wasn't enough. And then I realized, oh shit, I have to do my own band. Like, I have to do this.
That must have been a great feeling.
It was really scary until I played a show, and then I felt absolutely no fear and just the desire to do it again and again and again.
Great.
And then, like, absolute, looking back, like, complete, like, a modicum of good, you know, results. Like, nothing huge. It wasn't like, it's not like Fresh or even, you know, a huge band now. And it's not like we debuted, you know, playing these huge things and being a really big band. But, like, we got a feature on a blog site at that time that was run by Zach Cirillo.
Yeah, he's huge.
So his blog property, Zach, did a feature on Fresh in our first week. And then
your first week being a band.
Yeah, so we put out Gooing Chum, and then
great.
And then like Gooing Chum went up on Bandcamp, and then there was immediately the stream of people from the feature on Property of Zach to Bandcamp who were listening. And it just felt like by complete chance we had a little tiny bit of momentum. But for me, because I'd never experienced anything, it was huge. And it was like, oh my God, my band, like people are giving me physical money for a digital copy of an EP I recorded in a day in our guitarist's flat. Like, you know, it felt huge for me. And I think it would have been, I think it is huge for somebody of that age and that situation. I think that's really cool.
I think about that all the time. I think so many bands would be gassed, stoked to have that. Anyone's blog, anyone taking the time to write out, to write about you, that's the biggest compliment.
And, you know, in a way also I have to thank like the way the functionality of Bandcamp, because you know how like when a user on Bandcamp buys your music digitally, their little avatar pops up underneath your music. And then the more and more people buy it, suddenly there's this little wall of different faces. And also sometimes their profile pictures are just made up of other things they've bought. And sometimes those things might be album artwork you recognize, and they might even leave a comment. And so suddenly it's almost like, I mean, I never had MySpace, but it's what I imagine MySpace is with like your top friends. Like,
yeah, totally.
It's almost like this weird, this amazing public endorsement of your band from strangers. And I remember like seeing people from places from cities in America, you know, and countries that I'd never been to, and just being like, oh my god, this is so cool, and this blog from Philly has, you know, said that we're good, and
yeah.
And like, yeah. And so before that, I wasn't sure if I was good enough to be in a band, but after that, I just became the fully fledged narcissist that I am today, and since then I've never doubted that I shouldn't be in a band, to the point that I was just, you know, ridiculous about it. I like decided to stay in London for uni because of my band and everything. So
paint me a picture of your life when that first single came out.
When Get Bent came out, the super slow, super lo-fi, slightly out of tune version. I remember the first
time I heard it. It was you could feel the energy. It was brilliant.
Yeah, the energy was there for sure. I think that's all that matters. I think that must be what people picked up on, because it wasn't much to write home about in terms of like production at all, and yeah, and like performance, but yeah, it had the energy. I think I remember that must have been why we got that show with Supporting Ship Present in London. I think Iona liked the energy. Like, it's just like chance little leg ups like that that then kind of snowball. But yeah, at that time I was in my final year of, I was in year 13. I'd done all my like UCAS stuff. And I was like totally devoted to my band, which hadn't played a show yet, but we'd put out this EP. And like, I remember like my school like had a yearbook and they did like the superlatives, like the most nicest hair or most popular or whatever. There was one person who won best mixtape and he'd like dropped like a SoundCloud thing. And I was so annoyed. I was like, what the fuck? Like, have they not heard my fuck? Like, so I think I was just like very precocious, very... just like, it was honestly, it's a time in my life where I was like so excited and happy. I'm not happy now, but just like I think looking back, it was like a really exhilarating time, and like probably a time where I felt like I was finally getting validation for everything that I'd been working on or kind of experiencing in the last few years. Like, you know, I'd listened to so much indie rock and punk music, and but I didn't feel like I had a place in the scene at all. Not just because of my gender, but just because of like, I don't know. I don't know. And then like suddenly, to be able to say you're in a band, it's like a signifier of something.
you said on Culture Fear, run by brilliant Sean Sheehy.
Yeah.
I loved your guys' chat. And one moment that I felt a lot of love for was when you were playing music in school or college.
Yeah.
Where it was your little secret.
Yeah. Yeah. I had the band name Fresh since I was like 16. And I started writing the songs for the first EP when I was 17. So for like a sizable amount of time when you're that age, I think for that time it was like a band in my head that was like a utopian ideal of myself.
Yeah. Well, I think people can relate to that. Yeah. I think that's very relatable.
I think so. I think like when you're that age, everything is so intense. You know, even for the average teenager, and you're going through so much, and then to have this world in your head, or to have this kind of like ideal of yourself, it's honestly a refuge. Like, yeah, I didn't have the easiest teenage years. I had a really rough time, and yeah, like it was, I think all that intensity just went right into it. Maybe I should have put more effort into like therapy and CAMS and all the stuff that I literally just was willfully not doing what I should have been doing. But, you know, I mean, it worked out in that I'm still here. So
was there ever a conflict with that? And, you know, you mentioned you stayed in London to go to uni. So, you know, you carry on with the band. Was there any other conflict with education or work?
Not really. The things I'm good at, I'm not good at, like, I've got a really, really small, narrow, like, band of stuff that I'm good at. But I know how to handle that. I was I was always really good at languages and literature at school. And so, I don't know, it never occurred to me to not do both at the same time. I think I didn't get any of my unis and I went into clearing. And then the only option, and when I say I didn't get any of my unis, it was because I overshot it with my massive ego. And I'd applied to places where it was like, you know, A*, A*, A*. And I got an A*, A*, B or something, you know, something like pretty close. Oh my God, I didn't get out of bed for 3 days when I got those results. And looking back, I just want to like, I want to shake myself for just for like not like giving myself the self-respect to like to just recognize my abilities and stuff. Like, you know, I ran myself into the ground to get those A-level results while, you know, having a tough time. And yeah, so I didn't get any of my unis and I went into clearing, and the only uni that wanted me was Manchester for English Lit. And I didn't think I was ever going to study languages, but then I just thought, oh, why don't I just take a year out, work at the library in my school, work on my band and retake my French A-level and then see if I can study French in London. I don't really know how I came to any of those decisions, but I just did.
It's funny looking back now, you know, I guess. Like,
and in fact, that was the age that I met you and I met George and Dan and Iona and Andrew and Kay. I was in that part of my life. I was like redoing my A-levels and working for the first time.
at the library in your school?
At the library in my school, yeah.
That's such a smart job to have.
Well, my parents both have masters in librarianship. They're both librarians.
Wow.
So it's in the blood. It was a really, really easy job. It was pretty cushy. I honestly think I was like a mess when I went into clearing. I was so stressed. I think my headmaster like came down, and it was a Catholic school, and he was like, you know, this is all part of God's plan. You don't need to be stressed. Like, and I was just sitting in tears, like, you know, nothing of my pain. Like, you don't want to say it's part of God's plan to a 17, 18 year old. It's just, it's not going to go down well. But I think he felt so sorry for me that he offered me a job for a whole year. Maybe that's not the best way to get jobs based on pity, but it's better than not having a job. And then with that money, I bought like all my pedals that I still use today. Like I bought my Rat, my Tube Screamer.
Yeah. Signature Tube Screamer.
Yeah. Don't knock it. It's the best.
I'll happily borrow it off you anytime.
Oh yeah, of course. And a patch cable and a guitar lead.
And everything else. And a plectrum. That year working in the library, I mean, how, you know, looking back on it now, how many months did it take you to kind of roll into, you know, growing into that and growing into yourself when you were there?
I think, but when it started, I was like going to like really big corporate shows. But by the end of that year, I was going to little DIY shows and like I knew everyone. I was seeing bands like Narwhals and stuff by the end of that year and like kind of really, you know, I'd kind of realized that music was something that you could actually interact with, and you know, rock stars wasn't the only option.
Don't really exist.
Yeah, exactly. And I was playing guitar. I was able to play guitar standing up by the end of that year, which was just enough to you know, book shows and stuff. So I think that year was really crucial for me. It was the year I made loads of mistakes with my band in terms of like interpersonal relationships with members and, you know, like stuff like, and just organizing like practice. And like, we used to practice for £1 an hour at Camden Roundhouse Studios. I don't know if they still do it, but if you're under 25, you can practice £1 an hour there.
That is brilliant.
Their studios.
Were you practicing quite often? Were you being pretty?
That's the thing. I was, you know, once a week at minimum, come on, whatever. And then, you know, the other members of Fresh at the time, not all of them, but a couple of them. Well, one of them was 15. The drummer Diaz was 15. He was so talented.
Wow.
Incredible drummer, but a 15-year-old boy. So, you know, he's like, fuck off, I got GCSEs. And then the bassist at the time was in his own little scene band, and he was super focused on that. He definitely saw Fresh as a side project, which is fine. but you know, not fine for me.
So, well, I mean, this is all like such interesting, like real life shit, right? Because it's like, it's such a confusing thing in bands or groups where it's like, okay, how can I ask you to take this as seriously as me without sounding like a dickhead?
Yes, it's literally like, I don't know how to explain it to you, but I feel it in my bones that you should stop doing everything else and talking to other people, and you should spend all your time learning my songs and helping me carry heavy amps. And you know what? Like, honestly, I don't know what I did in a past life to deserve it, but Dan and George and Miles now, when I met Dan and George, they were the people I met first. They were immediately on that level with me. They were like, yeah, it was insane.
That's great.
I know for a fact that both of them liked Fresh before they were in Fresh, but to have somebody back you to that level, and also like somebody who you look up to because they were older and they were, and I loved their band and they were wiser, like, you know, so I was like, oh my God, like it really puts confidence in you. It's kind of like a mentor thing, I think. And yeah, I'm just so grateful for it.
If possible, if at all possible, you kind of need someone to help nurture you. You need someone older to hold your, you know, not hold your hand, but someone to give you advice.
Yes.
Someone to like be like, yo, have you thought about that? Because you might not have thought about that.
Yeah. And honestly, both Dan and George, maybe especially Dan at the beginning, because he's got more of a head for like admin and he can drive. So he's always kind of like, literally someone to be like, have you thought about what time we need to get there for sound check? Have you thought about how we're going to get amps there? And just, yeah, literal things that I would have just fallen apart organizing, and I'm still not very good organizing, but that Dan, especially having toured in kind of hardcore bands for so long, and just like, no, you know, being not only a really talented drummer, but he played bass for a long time.
Oh, right.
And just, yeah, like, yeah, just, I really feel like I had, you know, like, you know, in those cheesy, like, kind of like ITV morning shows where they're like, you know, and here's one I made earlier. I feel like somebody came up with me and like, here's some band members that are, you know, that are sensible and smart and compassionate and engaged and creative, and we made them earlier. You're fresh out the oven and you have no idea what
and you need
doing.
That you need that.
Yeah, but honestly, like, and I think you and I have talked about this briefly, in that entering quote unquote the scene at a younger age, like, you really are at the mercy of slightly older punks. And like, I think I was super lucky with Fresh, and just that we met so many people who had experience that I didn't have, that were just willing to like completely like go out of their way to help me.
Great.
And like,
yeah,
that's what Specialist Subject did, and that's what all the bands we toured with did. And yeah,
yeah.
Like,
yeah,
still do.
That's going to have such a massive positive force on you taking yourself more seriously.
Exactly. Like, if to be a teenage girl and to have three older men care about the band, that's very legitimizing. I wish it wasn't, but it is. You know, like, and so, yeah, I think it just made me feel like, oh, I can keep up with this. Like, I can keep up with these people.
that vote of confidence. You're like, oh,
yeah,
this, I am, like, I am of value.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, wow, I see myself as this scared little girl, but I must not be. Essentially. Yeah.
Did that put any pressures on you? I mean, the outside forces of your life, be it family, be it work, be it education / paying rent where you're living. I mean, you spent a year out in France. Was it a year?
Yeah. Yeah. And that was that was something that I was terrified about, catastrophized in my mind, built up, convinced it was going to be the end of the band. And it was like one of the best things I ever did, for sure. Allowed me to grow as a person.
Great.
When I wrote some notes for this, I wrote down a list of all the jobs I've had. That's my favorite job, teaching English in France, working as an English teacher. Like, completely, you know, working and living in a foreign country in a foreign language and having that confidence and discovering like a different part of myself.
Yeah.
And I mean, at that time I was 21 and I'd been in Fresh for a while, and I was convinced, wow, to say it now is insane, but I was convinced that as far as self-development went and friends I had, I'd hit the ceiling. I was never going to have any more friends in my life. I had enough friends. I was never going to grow in any kind of media. I was fully done. You know, I was so mature and so nuanced and so insightful about myself.
Yeah.
And then I get there and I was shocked that people who didn't at all listen to the same music as me mm-hmm. still wanted to be my friend. Mm-hmm. I was like, mm-hmm. wow. Mm-hmm. And that was super important for me. But yeah, and then like, after that, when I came back and I started my final year, Fresh was touring the States, and Fresh was doing big UK tours, and I was writing my dissertation and I was doing it remotely. I've said this to people individually. Sometimes people talk, or you know, there's other people who do their degrees and manage a lot of things while being in a band, and I say I never recommend doing what I did because it wasn't mentally healthy. Mm-hmm. I think I clearly felt like it was what I needed to do at the time, and I'm glad in retrospect, but I was honestly not in a good mental state. And I played Fest, and I'd never been to Fest before, and I sat there. I remember like landing, getting to our Airbnb, setting things down and going straight into the festival, like, you know, into a venue. And like, George was so excited that this festival he'd loved and kind of come out and seen before by himself, like just as a punter. He couldn't believe that his band was playing it. And I think Fresh was playing on the PA at this little venue. And like, sick. I was sitting there like, wow, I'm 22. I'm at Fest for the first time. And the reason I'm there is because I'm playing, and all I feel right now is just complete stress. And like, there was like personal shit going on, and like, I was just miserable. And I just remember being like, oh no, like, yeah, I do have everything I want technically on paper right now. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But you know, like at that moment, and it didn't last the whole weekend. The kind of 40 minutes we played were amazing, but that whole weekend aside from that, I was honestly crying in my room. Like, I was, you know, having a hard time.
Those perfect times can often quite feel very, you know, anything but. And equally, by equal measure, you can be going to France that you really catastrophized, and actually, you know, you've found all these, you know, you're part of your own story, and your story develops in a way that you had no foresight of.
It was the most mentally balanced, like, clarifying year of my life that I'd remembered for a long, long time, since I was like a small child. It was
great.
You know, one of the only years I wasn't on antidepressants. Like, it was, but you know, at the things I thought that would be good for me and that I thought would give me happiness were not the things that I you know, was accounting for and planning for. And I don't, but now, you know, that being said, I played one of my favorite shows at Fest. Mm-hmm. There were, you know, individual moments of a great time, and it was and you know, especially now when you're sitting here kind of like in COVID times thinking, Jesus Christ, I used to live that life. And I took it for granted. I was miserable the whole time. And I, you know, immediately kind of checked myself and I go, no, you were going through a lot. You were not mentally healthy. You know, you can't beat yourself up for something. You know, mm-hmm. hindsight's 20/20.
Totally.
And even on that tour, you know, on a wider scale around Fest, like, I had a great time. But for that younger teenager who was so excited that people bought her EP on Bandcamp, you know, she'd never... Yeah, I had no idea that I thought that these arbitrary markers of success, like touring the States and getting on a plane to go play a gig and having people love your band. Unfortunately, that isn't enough if you're not mentally healthy. If you're suffering from a mental illness, then all the, you know, external validation and wonderful opportunities and traveling isn't going to help. And it's only once you recognize that you can like find that balance. And I hope I found that balance, but I'm not going to assume, like I did when I was 21, that at 24, I've hit the ceiling at personal development, you know?
No, I think the last few years, I don't know if I've learned it fully yet. It's a process, but I look back and I think, do you know what? Those times, they don't own me. You know, that bad feeling doesn't own me. And actually,
yes,
it's up to me whether I let that get under my skin now. I mean, you kind of, it's not always true, but for me, sometimes it does work. Sometimes it's like, yeah, but do you know what? Like, maybe that was part of my journey. That was part of my test. That's definitely maybe who I am today.
You have that control over how you allocate that in your memory, over that stage of your life. You're so right. And like, and also I think if you have depression or anxiety or any kind of mental health issue, I suppose, but I can only speak to what I have in my brain, but like there's a tendency to mix up your mental illness for your personality, you know? Oh, I was miserable at that time. And because I was miserable and I was getting to play with a band I loved, getting to tour with a band I loved in another country, but you know, instead of being like, oh, I was going through, you know, an episode, it was like, oh, I don't like music, you know, which is not true. It's the furthest thing from the truth.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, mm-hmm. like what I've realized now is that honestly, like I feel like I those experiences are kind of like more worthwhile to me in retrospect, because I can look back and I can, that, you know, that they're not gone. I still did it, and I'm and now that I'm in a much better place, I can you know can look back and be like, I had, you know, yeah, I was really upset that night, but the next morning when we went and got coffee before going to see Slingshot Dakota, I was, you know,
yeah, great.
That was a lovely time, and that was a lovely interaction I had, and
yeah.
you know, that one show in North Carolina was really amazing, and et cetera, et cetera. Like they're not finite. You can still have those experiences, and you can like, you can reframe them, which is, I think, exactly what you just said. But yeah, like it's really hard. To not judge yourself for that, especially when you don't really understand mental health, which sucks because you'd think that if you had depression, you would understand depression.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, I just mistake my depression for, you know, inherent personality traits or like me being a horrible person. But it's like, it's not. It's just like there was something chemical going on, which is fine.
I wonder, like, as a songwriter, as an artist, as a lyricist, as a musician, all of those things that are all kind of their own separate things, whether that means that you do reflect just probably an inordinate amount. you know, you kind of have to. That's part of the job.
Yeah, I think I'm a very good retroactive reflector, but the problem with depression is that it completely lacks any self-awareness.
Right.
As a nature of it, as an illness. And so like in the moment, I have no insight into my own thoughts. I'm like, as well as I'm also a really anxious and overthinking kind of person. So I hyperanalyze everything I do, even in the moment. So I think my behavior's never suffered because of depression. Like I've never acted in a way really where I felt like, oh. But in terms of how I see myself and like my self-worth and my self-esteem, in the moment, it's like your brain is telling you that you're a fraud and you're, you know, faking it and you're not really whatever or whatever. And I completely believe it. And it's only after, depending on the severity, you know, maybe a month after or a week after or a year after, I'm like, oh, goddamn, I fell for it.
it's hard to live in the present, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's hard to look at things objectively. Especially when you're having a great tour or a great gig where you're like, can I hold on to this moment? But it's going too quick.
Oh, yeah. And you know that's not the moment that will come back.
Yeah, the moment that will come back.
Thing, you know?
Yeah. That's funny.
The time you played that show when you were 19 and your guitar strap fell off.
Oh, my God. Do you have any bad dreams? Have you got any sort of teeth falling out, guitar strings going out?
God, you know, I don't have any anxiety about playing. Like, and honestly, I don't deserve it because I've had faux pas and like all my power supply cut out on our first ever show in Europe. But like, but you're so right. It's the moments when I'm healthy and I'm like having like a wonderful time and I'm like creating my art and I'm interacting with people and I'm traveling and I'm, they're the times where my self-worth and self-esteem is like at the highest, but unfortunately they're not the times that I keep and like refer to as proof.
Don't know why.
It's the age-old mystery, I suppose, of everyone's fragile sense of self. But, you know, like, God.
We can talk at length about these things, and it always fascinates me. And I know I'm going back to my brand here, but it always fascinates me how the fuck people can work between all of that and continue good relationships with their boss.
Absolutely. Like, I never really meaningfully dated in all of the busy band times because I didn't have the emotional energy. Like, my band was just like everything. Like, so no long-term relationships. I treated my band as a job and I treated my uni degree as a job. I like didn't have any friends at uni, no social friendships because I lived in the, I'd commuted. I literally like, it was like going in for like a 9 to 5 for your lectures and stuff. And like that like yielded great results academically. But like, yeah, I am I sad I missed out on like a typical uni experience? Maybe. I don't know. Like, I feel like touring is like being in halls, right?
Totally.
In terms of like hygiene and shit. So
you went, that was in central London, that uni, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. It was so, like Strand.
And I do think I went to City in Islington. It's like once you're off campus, you're not going to, okay, I bumped into someone once or twice, but.
Oh my God. Yeah. London, right? Like 9 million people.
You're not going to see them. Like that's, no, it's not, you're not going to bump into each other at the cafeteria or whatever happened in Warwick or.
Exactly. Whereas when I was forced to go and live in, you know, a tiny, tiny rural village in the middle of nowhere in the south of France, there was no escape from anything anywhere. Like all my students saw exactly what I was buying in the supermarket and all their parents did too. And honestly, as a Londoner, like I realized I couldn't walk anywhere with headphones in anymore because people would just be going like, bonjour Catherine, like, oh my God, it's Catherine. And I'd be like you did not want to make the mistake of like looking like you were ignoring them when really you had your earphones in. So it's just completely different culture.
Brilliant. Love that. Will you go back to teaching, do you think?
Yeah, that's what I want to do with my, So my career goals, my corporate job career goals, like I always want to play music. I want to be like, you know, like an old woman and have like so many albums, like an extensive back catalog behind me. I absolutely want that. Mm-hmm. But practically, in terms of like living my life independently and meaningfully and making an earning, I want to, I mean, I've started it now, but I want to complete my master's. I want to get a PhD and I want to be a researcher and teacher.
Brilliant.
And yeah, like I work right now as a research degrees coordinator, and this whole year because of COVID I've had more time and I've worked as like a research assistant, and like I've been proofreading manuscripts and teaching assistant stuff, and like
amazing.
It's really filled a bit of a hole where live music has left it.
And that stuff comes naturally to you?
Yeah. Yeah, I think teaching's a bit like performing. When I was in France, like my youngest students were like 14. And then I had adult learners as well. I was teaching 30-year-olds as well, but like that was a bit different. So like, I don't know. I don't know if I'm a natural teacher yet, but I know I enjoy it and I want to work at it. And I just think it's like a really interesting profession, and it's like, I don't know. I think back to like my time as a young person, and like teachers were some of the most impactful people to me. So if I could, you know, do that as well as being able to like explore my own research and interests, that's literally like positive my mind.
Hell yeah.
I think I need a bit more confidence before I become a good teacher. I'm quite scared. Talking in front of people is scary in a way that singing and playing isn't for me.
Working in education as you're doing now, as you have, so I mean, you've basically worked in education since leaving school.
Kinda. I worked jobs in between, like I worked in Waitrose, I worked on the meat and fish counter, I had to gut fish, and I was a vegetarian. And I put on my application, right, I put, I'm a vegetarian, don't put me on the meat and fish counter. And then Waitrose was like, fuck you. I literally only lasted 3 months. I mean, because we were touring so much, I wasn't able to work there 35 hours a week. And I hated it. And it was for like £7.30 an hour. There was honestly, actually, the people were kind of nice. I liked chatting with my fellow fish gutters. But besides that, like, absolutely, that's the thing. I find it very hard to put in effort to something where there's no reward. Like, I was like, why am, like, yeah, there was no redeeming factor really there. You know, I was exhausted. I had to shower twice a day because I stank of fish. People literally like moved away from me at the bus. It was disgusting. Like, yeah, and my first week there, they were like to me, okay, when you get home, first take a hot shower to open your pores and get the smell out. Then take a cold shower so you actually get to clean yourself. Right. And it was just like, I remember, I had to wear like a shitty little uniform with a little tie and a little hat. Yeah. And it was in Richmond as well. It was the Richmond Waitrose.
Right.
So like the people were very demanding and high maintenance. Good people of Richmond, don't at me, but Jesus Christ. Like, they were like, yeah, I need my fresh salmon. I need my fucking thing right away. And I'm not the best at quickly picking up instructions, you know, like I have anxiety. If I'm faced with a cash register, I'll want to spend 10 minutes entering something in just to be sure I did it right. But then you've got, I've worked in Costa as well, like, and I remember like crying after every shift just because I was so anxious about it, and like looking back, it's all this wasted energy on things that I had no. But that's the thing, like, obviously you have to make money, you have to like just try and get by, but it does, you know, it does frustrate me that so much energy was wasted on something that has no bearing on like my life and plans.
You can get a real dull feeling on a Tuesday morning going to a job you don't like when it's raining.
Stop describing it. I'm getting it. It's coming, honestly.
Three
coming
changes
back
on the tube.
No, stop.
Oh, it's awful. It's awful. With the education system, is that like, I was just thinking, you know, about the language that, you know, talking as a teacher, you know, are you you must be picking up language and kind of body language as well, and all these kinds of parts that make up.
I think I've always been really good at talking to people and like reading people.
Mm.
That makes me sound like a psychopath, but I think that's fine. Like,
I think it's fine, yeah.
I'm good at that. And I think I'm also quite good at like putting out what I want to communicate. I think I'm a good communicator, and I think I'm good at intercepting other people. I think that's fine.
Mm.
But yeah, and you know what? Being in a band is all about that. Like, you're just with people and working with people all day.
Mm-hmm.
On a tour, you're living with them.
Mm-hmm.
You're interacting with a dozen different promoters and people in different contexts. You have to quickly remember things, and then when you perform, you have to kind of like gauge what the crowd is like. So I think that's that. And I think I've always liked language because my parents are Irish, and Irish was spoken a little bit at home, and I think I was always just interested in foreign languages and like speaking foreign languages.
Yeah.
And so I just, and yeah, you know, at primary school we learned Spanish and I loved Spanish, and then started French and loved French. And then I wrote my undergraduate dissertation on like queer translation and how translation is like this amazing vessel for like queerness, because it like bridges gaps. It's like intermediate, you know, like it goes between things. It's kind of like a clandestine thing. And like that's what I've been working at recently. I work as like, so like there's this workshop at King's called the Radical Translation Workshop, and like I help with like impact activities and like with the students and stuff, and we're like translating like 18th century like revolutionary French stuff that's never been translated into English, and we're all as a group bringing it into modern language in English, because like, you know, I think it's important that like revolutionary language, especially now, like is accessible. That's just as important to me as music is, but they completely activate different parts of my brain and my personality. I think I need both of them to like be fulfilled.
I've thought a lot about recently how music is a language.
Exactly, yeah. It's a universal language that and like you're so right in that as well, like we're kind of like transplanting ourselves across all these different cultures in bands. Like, it is really crazy that we're from one place and we have one cultural viewpoint, but for some reason, 500 people in Dusseldorf are really into that.
Yeah, like fest punk.
You know? Yeah. Like,
it's funny. It never fails to kind of make me laugh, and it kind of makes me happy, and it also opens my eyes to so many other stuff. I mean, I've been listening to quite a lot of Stereolab recently, talking about France.
Nice.
And, you know, that's like a whole world of its own that I like haven't even scratched the surface.
And like working for a year, working in France and being not French, you know, kind of being part of French society and their attitude towards work. Honestly, it's kind of ruined my work ethic. And I say this to all my friends, like all the girls I lived with, there was like four of us. And our only common language was French, because we had one Spanish person and then one Scottish person, one Welsh person, and then me. And so we were like representing all the nations. And so our only common language was like broken French, which was a really interesting way to like have a friendship. But like we have this really deep, beautiful, meaningful friendship of this weird language we have. But we all have talked about how like working, how like having 2-hour lunch breaks and like, and striking all the time and paying like 135 euro for your rent a month has like ruined us for going back to the UK. It's really radicalized all of us. I mean,
it's going to inform the way you look at life, isn't
it?
It
has. It has. Like, it's just, I feel more. I mean this in a good way, but it's also not good in terms of like maybe my ability to survive in our kind of horrible Tory austerity society. But I feel entitled now to more things.
Yeah,
why should I have to fucking break my back working a job I hate with no benefits when I know and I've tasted life working a meaningful job at 10% of the effort with so much time for like cultural enrichment.
Yeah.
Wow. We're helping someone right now, because I feel relieved.
Fucking me too.
Wow.
These conversations have saved me, you know.
I think I still have the habit. This is so funny because I just said I'm a great communicator, but I still definitely think of conversation as your turn to speak. But you're right. Like, it's not just an exchanging of information for the purpose of the listener.
No, there's an energy, like, isn't there?
Yeah.
And there's like experience and sharing experience.
But that only happens when it's a subject such as punk, that shared experience, when it's important. Like, and I think that's the thing, like in the corporate world, your exchange is not, you know, based off that energy, and it is to get, you know, for the goal of obtaining information. And that, yeah, that's hard. It's, yeah, you're walking this line, there's two switches in your head, and sometimes you get it wrong and you bring your punk switch to work, or suddenly you're analyzing something in punk with your corporate frame of mind, and you have to shake yourself and go, what the hell am I doing?
Lyrics, you know, inform that. You know, how many times in your life have you been in a difficult situation and a song line from, I don't know, one of your favorite bands, for me it's sometimes Jawbreaker or Save the Day. Which sometimes aren't necessarily the best lines to think of, because they can be really, you know, catastrophic, but, you know, catastrophizing, I mean. But lyrics are so much in punk rock, aren't they?
Yeah. And exactly. And they bleed into, that's the thing, they're universal. But because people can't separate them from the sound, they don't get that recognition. But you're right, as lyrics and as language, it's completely universal. People don't see that. But like, for some reason, I worked a part-time job for years at Resident Studios.
Yeah.
I've only recently just kind of stopped because of how I've been lucky enough to get permanent employment at King's. Yeah, for years I worked at the studio, you know, 0-hour contract. I was working 5 p.m. to midnight. And like, for some reason, the one song I would always listen to on the way there and the way back was War Pigs by Black Sabbath.
Fucking ace.
Because I don't know why. I think my mind was like, even if it was music, like it wasn't a career I was interested in advancing. And so it's like, you know what, lovely, lovely, kind studio with people I am really, you know, have deep connections with and friends with. Fuck you. You're no better than the fucking generals gathering in their masses or whatever. Like,
that's brilliant, you know, because you've got to take responsibility for what you want to do. And sometimes that is going to be the case.
Yeah.
And you have to, you know, I mentioned it earlier on in the chat where it's like, you know, you have to do it for yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, I mean, that studio kept me financially stable throughout touring. It was the one job where it allowed for touring. So everyone was touring. But like, I'm also glad that part of my life is over, because I can't deny the work I want to do in research and stuff. And I've got, and you know, yeah, I don't want to work in a studio. Mm. I mean, honestly, I like recording as an artist, but yeah, that part doesn't really interest me much. Mm-hmm. So yeah, like it feels really good to just like, I think that's the word part-time job. It like, it implies this kind of like transience and like moving in and out of stuff and like picking this up and dropping this. And like, I think those jobs are so trivial. And like, I definitely got flack for years from my parents. Why are you working this minimum wage job at the studio? And it's like, this is what I need to do right now. Mm-hmm. This suits me. Mm-hmm. This job is fine that I don't put all of my life and soul into making sure that the rehearsal bands don't steal the mic stands. Like, I can read my uni work at my desk, and I can, you know, this is what I need for me at this part of my life. And that's what a part-time job should be. It should act as a support and support you through a part of your life. And it should not like eclipse your energy and your commitment to what you're really passionate about doing. And that notion is just completely faded. You know, any kind of job you do has to be your life. Just out of sheer, it's exhausting. And I think if I was neurotypical, I'd struggle with it, but I'm insane. You know?
Well, that's what you just said. That's so vital. Thank you. You know, thank you. You helped me there.
Oh, mate. Thanks. Yeah.
You have to remember to know, you know, remember to not forget.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And that does sound like it should be pasted on a magnet.
So
but that's
true.
Because it's important and it should be looked at every day when you go to get your milk out of the fridge.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, like, yeah, totally. That is, and it's those kind of, they sound cliche when you say them, but you know, you kind of wish they were cliche, more cliched in your mind or cemented in your mind. And you wish that you, what's the word?
Take that more seriously.
Yeah.
Or like just give it the time, give it the weight.
Yeah. 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 Believe them.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. Yeah.
Because you just cast it aside, don't you? But yeah, like I think I like routine, I like structure, I like stability, and that's not great for touring. But ultimately I just know that for the very, very, very long foreseeable future, like my life is gonna be fitting my career interests around music, because that's what I want. And that's not gonna lend itself to like the most easiest of times in the future. Like it's gonna mean I'm gonna have to like make sacrifices and be really stressed, but I know it's what I want to do, and that's enough to like buoy me up to get me through it, I think.
Catherine, that's amazing. I've really enjoyed that. Thank you so much for being
here. I feel like I've had an epiphany. Thank you, Giles, for having me. I love this podcast, like your episode with Francis from Hop Along.
Fuck yeah, yeah.
Like I love this podcast, and so it's, I can't believe I've been admitted into the canon. I'm like, wow.
No, pleasure to have you. So that was Catherine from Fresh. I absolutely loved that chat. I feel like I've taken away a lot from that, and I hope you have too. Fresh's new record, The Summer I Got Good at Guitar, is out now on Specialist Subjects Records. Go and have a look at either of their websites or Bandcamps to see what you can get physically there. And you can also have a look at my book, 35-page illustrated hardback of excerpts from the first 101 episodes of the podcast at 101parttimejobs.com, where you can see screenshots and have a look at the cover before you purchase, if you so wish. Thanks again for listening. Here's Cock Sparrow. I've been working all day, bobbing my head on the side, running around like a blue-ass fly. I've been working, yeah, I've been working all day, bobbing my head. Every blink of me, I've been on the go. Up and down the ladder like a fiddler's elbow. I've been working, yeah, I've been working all day, bobbing my head. This is a Mighty Moon Media podcast.